Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest is writer David Barron. He has served as science correspondent for NPR and chair in anthropology at the Library of Congress. And we're talking about his book, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. David, welcome back to the show. I love this book. This book is as I've talked to you before, it's cinematic in its scope and it's the way that it proceeds. How did you come to write about this particular eclipse?
Well, it's a long story. I'll try to make it relatively short. So I saw my first total solar eclipse in 1998 in Aruba, and it was a life-changing experience. It was, I dare say, a spiritual experience. It was the most glorious thing I'd ever witnessed. And as a science writer, again, in 1998, I thought, you know, I would like to write a book about eclipses. But I knew that the next total solar eclipse to cross the United States wouldn't occur until 2017, so 19 years later. So I had 19 years to figure out what the book would be that I wanted to come out to, timed for the eclipse of 2017. And so over the years, I was exploring different ideas. Maybe I'd do something contemporary about modern-day eclipse chasers like me now. I go all over the world to see total eclipses. But I found that the best stories really were from the 19th century, which is when total solar eclipses weren't just things to gawk at, but they were very important for science, for astronomy. And these grand expeditions would be sent to the far corners of the Earth for an event that lasts all of usually 2 or 3 minutes. And so I started to explore the different eclipses. There was one that, this is back in the late 19th century, one that crossed Thailand, another that crossed India, across the Mediterranean, and they all had interesting stories with interesting people. But then I came across the total eclipse of 1878. And when I learned that a total solar eclipse crossed America's Wild West, and that of all people, Thomas Edison was in Wyoming for the eclipse, right before he invented the light bulb, I thought, there's got to be something here. And the deeper I went into researching it, just the richer and more interesting the story became.
Oh, my God, is there a story here. For the benefit of the audience, let's talk a little bit about solar eclipses, which is very different. When we're recording this, there's about to be a lunar eclipse, I think, tomorrow. That's not the same. Solar eclipses have, for millennia, frightened and inspired people. As a matter of fact, your book starts with a scene right out of a horror movie that was a reaction to the solar eclipse you're writing about. People have often reacted to this. How often do solar eclipses, total solar eclipses occur?
Right, and I'm glad you made that distinction.
Yeah.
So there are partial solar eclipses and there are total solar eclipses. And partial solar eclipses, almost everyone has seen. They're not that rare. They happen some, you know, they're visible from at least part of the Earth, a large part of the Earth, a couple times a year. And in a partial eclipse, if you look at it with special glasses, you need to protect your eyes, you can see the sun turn into a crescent as the moon passes in front of it. And it's kind of interesting to see, but you know, that's about it. A total solar eclipse, which requires that the moon totally covers the sun, is a much rarer event for any given point on Earth. Although they do occur about once every 18 months, it's only along a very narrow path, about 100 miles wide. And any given point on Earth will see a total eclipse about once every 400 years. That's how rare they are, unless you travel to see them. But in a total solar eclipse, you actually can look up at the sun with the naked eye. That's the only time that it's safe. So the surface is covered, the surface of the sun, but you can see what's around the sun, which is the sun's outer atmosphere, the solar corona, which is the most beautiful sight in the heavens. It's kind of this wispy, almost like it's made out of cotton. These strands of silk is what it looks like, kind of a wreath in outer space. And you can actually see bright stars come out and the planets in the daytime. It's like you're looking at an alien sky. I mean, that was my experience in Aruba in 1998 when I saw my first total eclipse. And when it became total and I could take off my eclipse glasses, I looked up in the sky and I sort of felt like I'm not on the planet Earth anymore. I've been transported to some other place. It's almost like space travel. You're really looking at outer space in a whole new way. So it is, I mean, if you didn't know what was happening, it would be terrifying. And it has been terrifying over the centuries. And even today, even when you know it's coming, even when you've traveled to go see a total eclipse, when you first take off those eclipse glasses, it is kind of, it's awe-inspiring in the old sense of awesome. Mm. That is, it's terrifying. It's both beautiful and terrifying. You understand that you're a tiny speck and that, you know, there are forces in nature that are so much larger than you can conceive.
And my experience, I've only seen a couple, is that it's not that it's just totally dark at totality. There's a weird, eerie, like violet blue or some kind of weird texture to the lighting around you that's not, you don't see at night either.
It really is surreal. Yeah, it's not like night. It's sort of like a weird twilight.
Yeah.
And, I mean, during the peak of totality, so when you're literally in the shadow of the moon, it is dark overhead, but not dark like midnight. It's, you know, sort of like a dark twilight. But on the horizon, it's still light because you're seeing where daylight is, you know, miles away. And so you have this weird effect of a 360-degree sunset all around you while it's dark overhead. And again, you certainly can see, if the skies are clear, planets. When I saw my first eclipse in Aruba, I could see three planets, Jupiter, Mercury, and Venus, flanking the sun. And so I was literally, and I really had this visceral sense, I was looking at the center of the solar system, and I could see the planets as they were orbiting the sun. It was like I was, you know, it was a diagram from my high school textbook about the solar system, but here it was in front of my very eyes. It was just, truly, it was gobsmacking is what it was.
So in this book, American Eclipse, there's an eclipse predicted for Monday, July 29th, 1878. But the pathway of totality, as you mentioned, which is very, very narrow relatively, is only going to pass through, as you mentioned, the Wild West. And there's all this interest at that time in the eclipse. People wanted to determine certain things about the corona. There were people looking for a predicted planet. Talk about that. I mean, they thought that they were going to be able to see this during total eclipse.
Right. So, again, the reason why scientists would plan these elaborate expeditions that would take months of planning and weeks of travel for something that would only last a few minutes is because it was such a rare opportunity to study the sun and the inner solar system. So first of all, as I mentioned, during a total eclipse, you can see the sun's outer atmosphere called the solar corona. Well, we know that's what it is today. It's the sun's outer atmosphere. But back then, all they knew is during a total eclipse, you would see this weird aura around the sun, and people didn't know what it was. Was it even real? Maybe it was some effect of light scattering in our own atmosphere during a total eclipse. Maybe it was the atmosphere of the moon backlit by the sun. Or maybe it was, so other people thought it was maybe meteors raining down on the sun. They really didn't know what it was. But also, there was, at the time, there was widespread belief that Mercury was not the closest planet to the sun. The way Mercury's orbit behaved, it didn't quite align with the predictions of Newtonian mechanics. And so the way that astronomers explain this is that they thought there was another planet closer to the sun than Mercury that was kind of tugging it along in its orbit. And they gave it a name. The planet was called Vulcan. And no one had ever seen it. There were some people who thought they had, but it wasn't really credible. But that wasn't a surprise, because if you had a planet that close to the sun, it would never be in the sky at night. It would set with the sun. And you couldn't see it in the daytime because it would be lost in the sun's glare. So the only time you might catch a glimpse of Vulcan would be during a total solar eclipse, when the moon would block the bright face of the sun, and you could see if there was a planet just outside the sun. And so one of the big things that astronomers wanted to do during the eclipse of 1878 was to see if they could find the planet Vulcan.
The thing that your book does very well is set the stage. First of all, in America, this was the Gilded Age. I forget who was President Rutherford B. Hayes, one of those presidents
right.
not a lot of people remember. But it's this thing where several different crews of wannabe either astronomers or wannabe astronomers decide to converge on areas of Colorado and Wyoming to try to view this eclipse. And each group and person has a story. And some of the stories are quite amazing. So we're going to talk about a few of them. But we're not going to – I don't want to give away the ending of the book because there is a
okay. –
there is an ending to it. I mean, there is a – you're building up to a tremendous thing. People need to read the book. But let's talk about some of these people. James Craig Watson, infamous as a planet hunter. Talk to me about that.
Right. So back in the 19th century, asteroids – which, of course, are tiny little planetesimals that orbit the sun, mostly between Mars and Jupiter. Not very many had been found, and discovering asteroids was a big deal. And at that time, asteroids were considered planets. They were called minor planets, but they got names just like the major planets, and finding an asteroid was a very big deal. James Craig Watson, who was an astronomer in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan, was renowned as a planet hunter. He had found several, and he was in a race to with another American astronomer to be the one to find the most, at least in the United States. Well, so he when he went out to Wyoming for the eclipse of 1878, he was determined to find that that planet Vulcan. Did you hear that strange noise on my phone?
No.
Oh, okay. No, I just got a text. I'll repeat that. Sorry.
Okay.
So James Craig Watson, he went out to Wyoming in 1878, determined to find that hypothetical planet, Vulcan. I mean, if anyone knew how to find strange objects, new planets orbiting the sun, it was James Craig Watson.
He discovered six new asteroids in 1867 alone.
Right. Yeah. So he had a big ego too.
I think the phrase you use in the book, and this stuck with me, is a corpulent narcissist.
He was a large man too. Yeah, yeah. His students called him Tubby. So he was a large man both in size and in ego.
Now, the star, if you could, and I guess you could definitely say this, was Thomas Alva Edison. Now, he's not an astronomer. How did he get involved in this?
Yeah, it was so interesting getting to know Thomas Edison. You know, I mean, we all think we know Edison, right? I mean, he's become this iconic figure. And to me, I mean, growing up, I mean, I always pictured Edison as this, you know, this famous older man who had done so much. But this is a young Thomas Edison. This was Thomas Edison at the very beginning of his career. And what a fascinating guy. So he, as I was very surprised to learn, because Edison, you know, was famously a very practical man, right? He would make practical inventions. And he talked about how, invention is, 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. But early in his career, he kind of wanted to be a scientist. That is, not just an inventor, but someone who discovered fundamental truths about nature. And he hobnobbed with academic scientists. And he had this idea that he was trying to make discoveries that would, you know, go beyond just invention. And so he, for the eclipse of 1878, actually came up with an invention specifically to study the solar corona, that mysterious aura around the sun that can only be seen during a total eclipse. It was called the tizimeter. Today we would call it a kind of a very basic infrared detector, but it was kind of like an electric thermometer. You could point it at something, and it would measure heat coming off of it. But he said it could measure differences in temperature as small as a millionth of a degree Fahrenheit. May have been an exaggeration, but it was.
Being generous.
Yeah. Well, so his plan was to bring it along to Wyoming, and he did, to point it at the solar corona to see if that strange halo gave off heat as well as light.
He's saying this tessimeter is going to be able to read the temperature of the corona from Earth.
Correct. Which actually is not ridiculous. I mean, he was kind of a pioneer in what today is known as infrared astronomy. I don't know that there's a direct line from the Kazimeter to our infrared telescopes today, but it actually was kind of an inspired idea, you know, that there are parts of the spectrum of electromagnetic radiation that's not just light, but is it's infrared, it's heat. And his device was to detect that. And, you know, so there are things in outer space you can't see, but you can actually measure by their heat. And that's what his dosimeter was designed to do.
Okay, but there's a big leap between what it was designed to do and what it could actually do.
It was not a very good device. And in the end, I would say, who's ever heard of the dosimeter, right? It's
right,
not on the list of Edison's inventions that anyone knows about today. That was his intent in 1878 to show that his dosimeter would help solve the mystery of the solar corona.
But there's another aspect of Edison, which you bring out really well in the book. He was a supreme self-promoter. He was always promoting the myth of Edison. He never let up. He was an expert at it. And that really colors the reader's feelings about Edison, I have to say.
Well, I mean, it's probably true of so many people, you know, like in Silicon Valley today, you're not only an inventor, you're a business person and a promoter. And that was part of Edison's success. He would, you know, his dosimeter, he was touting that his dosimeter would be this fantastic new invention even before he had figured out how to make it work. And he would use that same technique when it came to the light bulb. A year later, he was touting his light bulb as the greatest new sensation before he figured out how to really get it to work. But that enabled him to generate excitement and money to make it work. It's part of how Edison worked.
I love how his invention that you start with Edison is his electric pen. And that sounds like a Tom Swift book title, Thomas Edison and his electric pen. What was the electric pen? Like, what was it really like?
Well, the electric pen was sort of like a tattoo ink pen.
Oh, okay.
I've never had a tattoo put on me. It looked like a pen, and it had this little kind of needle that would come out the end in rapid fire. And if you drew with it on a piece of paper, it would create these little holes in the paper along the line that you drew, whether you were, you know, writing a letter or signing your name. And that would allow you then to mimeograph what you wrote. So it would basically make a stencil on a piece of paper.
Wow.
You could put it in a machine, and it was a way of making copies of something. And it was interesting. I discovered that there were some of the documents that were sent out to folks who were going out west for the eclipse of 1878 were copied by use of Edison's electric pen. It was a successful invention.
That's amazing. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is writer David Barron. He has served as science correspondent for NPR and chair in anthropology at the Library of Congress. But tonight, we're talking about his book, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. Now, the team, if I had to pick a team, and I sort of feel like I have to, it was Maria Mitchell's team. Let's talk about Maria Mitchell.
Yes. Well, and I should say she pronounced her name Mariah.
Mariah, excuse me. You're right.
Maria. But Mariah Mitchell, I loved so many of the characters I wrote about, but I would say she was my favorite. Mariah Mitchell was by far the most famous female scientist in America in the late 19th century. She was an astronomer. She actually was from Nantucket originally, and she rose to fame by discovering a comet. Actually, she was the first American to discover a comet, and she received a gold medal from the King of Denmark for that. Well, by 1878, she was now getting on in years, and she was teaching astronomy at Vassar College, which was a relatively new all-female college in Poughkeepsie. And in 1878, remarkably, she put together an all-female expedition to Denver, Colorado, to study the eclipse. And this is at a time when, of course, there were very few professional women in science. And Mariah Mitchell was excluded from the teams being put together of these male astronomers going west. There was all sorts of support being provided to male astronomers who wanted to go west for the eclipse, but she couldn't get it herself, so she took it upon herself to assemble her own expedition out west.
What was amazing to read was, of course, everybody knew Edison, and there was big hoopla, even though it was way out west, about Edison. But people also knew about Mariah. I mean, they knew her. They knew of her and her role in women in science.
Yeah, she was quite prominent. A couple of years before had given a speech about the role of women in science and really calling on women to go into the sciences. And that talk was widely printed, including out in Colorado. So she was quite a famous person at that time.
The story, your book has so many stories. First of all, one of the big stories is just getting to where they can view the eclipse. And so obviously they're going by train. You can't really drive through all the roads. But one of the trains was really decked out. It was like traveling super executive class.
Yeah, there was a Pullman Palace car is what they were called. And that's how Edison and the small crew he went with.
Well, he wasn't the head of his crew, right? It was Henry Draper?
Right, exactly. So Henry Draper, and there were several others who were, again, academic scientists. And Edison went along with them. He was invited to go with them. And they had their own palace car to go west. So they were having fine dining as they were crossing the plains of Nebraska and Wyoming to get out to Rawlins, Wyoming, which was a very rough railroad town that was in the path of the total eclipse, and that's where they made their base of operations.
Now, other people arrived in, let me say, much less luxurious accommodations. I think, was it Simon Newcomb's government eclipse group arrived in a tiny speck called Separation?
Yes, exactly. So again, the path of totality, which is where the moon's shadow would fall, about 100 miles wide, went north to south across Wyoming, and it intersected with the Transcontinental Railroad, which went east to west. And so there were a few stations along the Transcontinental Railroad that were within the path of totality. Rawlins, Wyoming, this railroad town where Edison was the largest. It still was a tiny place. But, a bit west of there in the path was a station called Separation, which was basically just like a station master there. And there was a place to provide water and coal for the trains. But it was camping out. And you had these prominent scientists like Simon Newcomb, who was a very famous astronomer at the time. They were just living in tents for the eclipse.
And it's amazing to compare that with, there were people in Denver, Colorado, but then there were also people up on the top of Pikes Peak.
Yes, right. So Pikes Peak over 14,000 feet high. And that was another great story. There were several astronomers who wanted specifically to observe from so high up, hoping that because there would be less atmosphere above them, they would have a clearer view of what was going on up in the sky. And indeed, the view from the top of Pikes Peak was spectacular. And one of the astronomers who went up there, his name was Cleveland Abbey. He started out as an astronomer. He then became a prominent meteorologist. In fact, he's been called the father of the National Weather Service. He established what became the National Weather Service. But he went in 1878 out to observe the eclipse from the top of Pikes Peak. He, after several nights up there, developed life-threatening altitude sickness and had to be evacuated the night before the eclipse on a stretcher halfway down the mountain. And he ended up having to just observe the eclipse from about 10,000 feet lying on his back.
Oh, my God.
Just one.
And there's so many stories. Each group had its stories. Mariah had a story. It was it's amazing. We're almost out of time, and I just want to mention that at the end of the book and the afterward, you write a really heartfelt tribute to somebody who I've interviewed several times, and that was Jay Pasikoff. Can we just mention him for a minute or two?
Absolutely. Yeah. Jay Pasikoff, who for a long time was a professor of astronomy at Williams College in Massachusetts, he observed basically every solar eclipse total or partial that he could during his lifetime. He saw dozens of total eclipses and was a real evangelist. And it was Jay Pasikoff who turned me into an eclipse chaser. I, back in 1994, was a science reporter for NPR, did a story about a partial eclipse that year, interviewed Jay Pasikoff, and he's the one who explained to me the difference between a partial eclipse and a total eclipse. And he described in detail just how glorious a total eclipse is. And he said to me, you know, before you die, you owe it to yourself to experience a total solar eclipse. And he said it with such passion and sincerity that he convinced me. It was because of Jay that I saw my first total eclipse in 1998 in Aruba, and it literally changed my life. And Jay, unfortunately, died of cancer a few years ago. And I thank him in my book for changing my life and inspiring the book.
I'm thankful that I got a couple of chances to talk to him. And I had no idea who he was when I started, and only picked it up as we went along in different interviews. He was an amazing person, and it was great that you, and fitting that you ended the book with him. However, you also ended the book with the idea that experiencing an eclipse is a really special event. And if you have the chance to do it, it could change your life.
I totally agree with Jay, and I've become an evangelist trying to tell people that they really should make it a priority. You know, we had the total eclipse that crossed the country in 2017. Then there was another April 8th of 2024. That's the one that came across northern New England. And for anyone who missed those, the next total eclipse to be visible from any significant portion of the United States won't be until 2045. But put it on your calendar, August 12th, 2045, and that one will cross Pikes Peak in Colorado.
Oh, wow.
So I'm planning on sticking around for that one and getting myself up top of Pikes Peak. But, of course, about every 18 months or so, there is a total eclipse somewhere on Earth. This summer in August, there's one that will go from Greenland to Iceland to Spain. Next year, early August, there's a total eclipse that will cross North Africa across the Sahara.
Hey, I think the idea of seeing one a total eclipse in Iceland sounds good to me.
Yeah, well, the one that will cross the Sahara in 2027 will last for over 6 minutes.
Whoa.
In the right place, which is about as long as they ever get. And, of course, being in the Sahara, the odds of clear skies are pretty darn good.
We got to stop.
So if you can afford it, that's one to really get yourself to.
We got to stop. My returning guest tonight is writer David Barron. He's served as science correspondent for NPR and chair in anthropology at the Library of Congress. And we've been talking about his book. It's a spectacular book. It's a great read. American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. David, it's been great to talk to you again.
Mark, my pleasure. Always happy to talk to you.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.